The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
It is a great pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in New York. Our members will be very familiar by now with Bob Robotti, the founder, president, and chief investment officer of Robotti and Company Advisors, a registered investment advisor based in New York City. Guided by the classic tenets of value investing, Robotti and Company uses a proprietary research approach to identify companies with solid balance sheets and the ability to generate significant amounts of free cash flow, yet are misunderstood, neglected, or just out of favor. Once identified, Robotti's investment team focuses on deep primary industry and company research to select investment holdings through the lens of a long-term business owner. In this capacity, Bob sits on the boards of Panhandle Oil and Gas, AMREP Corporation, and Pulse Seismic Data, for which he also serves as chairman. Prior to founding Robotti and Company in 1983, Bob was the CFO of Gabelli and Company. Bob holds a BS from Bucknell University and an MBA from Pace University. I am truly grateful to Bob for having been with us on numerous occasions in the past. He has really been a mentor to the MOI Global community by sharing his ideas as well as his wisdom. And so I am very grateful that he has chosen this opportunity to be with us again. So on behalf of the MOI Global community, Bob, a very warm welcome. Please go ahead.
Hi, John. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Thank you all for running in. So as John said, I'm Bob Robotti, the founder and of Robotti and Company. Well, of course, our goal over time is to outperform the market. How do you do that? What's the difference? We think you do need some kind of edge. There are three like well-identified edges. And we think by having a 3 to 5 year time horizon and sticking to that and really having that long view, you know, that kind of does give us both an analytical and an informational edge in terms of the data we look at and the information that we're trying to identify, which is the impact on it, that information flow gives to the long-term value of the business. Important, of course, if you're going to have a 3 to 5 year time horizon, especially in current markets and the volatility that you have, you're going to need a behavioral edge. And that is, you know, really have to have the capability to have the conviction of the work you've done. Of course, always retesting it to make sure that things haven't changed and things develop differently. But to have that conviction when the market tells you you're wrong. So the behavioral edge, we think, is the most important and key component to be able to have. And we think we have that based on over 40 years of having been an investor myself. The idea of value investing, we think it's a pretty big tent, as Jean-Marie Evrard is well known as having said. I'm sure others of us thought similar things. And, over time, Ben Graham, of course, was the founder of it all and had a lot of investment thoughts and processes that, of course, is still key and fundamental today to being a real investor as opposed to a speculator. Of course, over time, there's been many adaptations in which many of us have had learned great things from Buffett in terms of how do you apply those rules in a more expansive way. But there definitely are many different schools of practicing value investing. That said, we do think that what's really happened in, over time is more and more people have done well in recent years for sure with better businesses. And therefore, there's been a gravitation in the tent, you know, to one side of the tent, we think, and maybe a little bit away from a more traditional value approach in more traditional basic prosaic businesses. Today, we think even today, value investors have a bias, and the bias is to invest in companies that have differentiation, moats, and have managements have been serial compounders. And there are great advantages to that. Of course, the perennial problem potentially with that is the price at which you pay, because in addition to having a great business that, you know, is trading at less, that you need to have it trading for less than it, the future cash flows discounted down to today. And instead, many investors, even value investors today, are staying away from cyclical companies, especially if they're commodity, if they're capital intensive, if there's any hint of leverage on the balance sheet. And of course, more traditional businesses, a number of them are subject to technological disruption. And how does that enter into the equation? But, you know, as John Templeton and many other people have said, if you're going to perform better than the market, you have to do something different than the market. And we think by sticking to the core tenets we've had, we think that's the way it's going to work for us and our investors. And key to then investing in cyclical businesses, you know, is really understanding economic cycles. And, of course, what you really want to do is there are times where you clearly are hesitant to invest in cyclical businesses because the results have been good, the performance strong, therefore capital has been attracted, probably excesses are coming to the business, and valuations are stretched. Instead, in difficult times, all those things unwind and go the other way, and we think there's great opportunity. And in addition to the fundamentals of the business and consolidation in cyclical businesses and opportunity sets that open themselves up, the valuations tend to get discounted based on poor performance, and especially if that's an extended downturn, because then the valuations continue to get further discounted as some investors had hoped for recovery, and that recovery doesn't materialize, therefore further discounts occur again. And Seth Klarman's first line here we think is interesting, and that is it's much easier for investors to sell what has been a disappointment. Disappointing investors' expectations, no matter how inexpensive it's become. And that's what we would observe, that, you know, there's a continual, it's probably a 10-year process where traditional value investors have performed poorly, you know, are in liquidation, redemptions, and therefore continued selling of securities, that is this subgroup, and no group stepping up to the plate, especially since you know, a lot of the capital flows today are predicated on performance of the security as opposed to the underlying fundamentals of the business. And so we think that was absolutely the case in the fourth quarter between rotation movements, the market generally being down, redemptions, liquidations. You know, there were people selling securities, I'm sure, that were at valuations that they, of course, normally would have been buyers at those prices, but in order to meet redemptions, they were sellers. So we think that kind of really set the opportunity. The industry I'm going to talk about, that I'm sure if any of you have heard me speak before, is energy, and it is oil. And it can't help but not be thinking about it given what's happened to oil securities, oil prices, all of those things, the dismal view. We think capitulation happened in the fourth quarter. You know, we think the oil service indexes are probably trading at 10 or 15 year lows. Even premier companies like Schlumberger, who've got great records and high returns on capital, you know, discounted to valuations below where they were, you know, in the financial crisis even. So there's we think the opportunity set in terms of valuations is extremely dramatic. What we've also done is we've invested in this industry for 40 years. And, you know, there's people always say it's different this time and this cycle is worse than other times. The fact of the matter is this cycle is not, you know, I've been an investor in the area since 1976, you know, the late early 80s to the mid 90s, the oil industry was in much worse condition than it is today. Many more bankruptcies and an extended period of time. So much more difficult. So it is cyclical. It does return. And that said, we're not blind, of course, to the risk that, you know, in conventional oil, which also is oil and gas, you know, the oil equation is clearly in at least a maturation, if not in decline, at least in some of its uses, and that is, you know, light transportation. So, you know, that's a real thing that really does change a little bit the cycles, but it really doesn't change it when you're at the bottom of the cycle and the pessimism is as bleak as it is today, we do think. And particularly in energy and oil, what we really think is there's an opportunity in offshore, because what's also happened within the business is, you know, a dynamic that everyone knows about and is aware of is onshore in North America. The oil shale revolution boom has really had an impact at the margin. There's no doubt about it, except we do think that the impression of what its role is and the impact that it's broad as it is, given the total world energy markets, is not nearly as great, and the costs are misunderstood. And the chart we've got up here indicates that over the last, but going back to 97, so over 20 years, the industry in most years has not replaced the reserves that it's been producing. So you've got declining production. And of course, in recent years, the significantly, you know, off the chart numbers in terms of lack of replacement, and therefore every oil well depletes and therefore sets up in the shorter term, the demand for incremental production, we do believe. Here's a chart that I think is really important because I think also people would misunderstand what's happened in the energy and especially the oil service business over the last 5-6 years. And the presumption is that the decline in the price of oil was really the precipitating event. We just totally disagree with that. the chart here we think is really interesting, because what you do see is in 2013, the total projects that were sanctioned at the time were $239 billion. The next year in 2014, it was $88 billion. Oil price did not break in 14. It broke at the end of 14. What we really think we have as a story here is it's the margin that you make. And clearly the price of oil is the selling price, but it's the costs that are relevant too. And what really had happened in 11, 12, 13, 14 is that costs had risen dramatically. Therefore, the margin, even at $100 oil, was really not economic, and companies were not generating returns on their invested capital. So that's what really brought about the decline in the oil service businesses, that cost inflation, but also, you know, at high levels of activity that were in those years, inefficiencies in the system, cost overruns, project delays, all kinds of cost push really made it uneconomic. And so therefore, that's what really drove the decline in activity. What you've seen in recent years is a rebound in activity, and the projections are that that should continue to increase in the current year, despite the price of oil. Like, well, why is that, and how could that be the case? Here's a chart that shows, you know, what the break-even cost of oil discoveries and new development activities in offshore areas is. And it starts with early 16, so it doesn't go back as far as 13 and 14, where costs were even much higher than that. But you've seen over this period of time a significant reduction in costs. And there's a number of factors that are accounting for that. Some will probably persist forever. Some will persist for an extended period of time, and some will persist for shorter periods of time. So there's many different components as to what's driving that. But the fact of the matter is it's come down. The next slide really highlights that fact. And here's a chart that really shows how many projects are out there that have been identified, that have been in inventory for the last 10, 15 years that didn't make it through the funnel in 14 because the costs had risen to the point where even at $100 oil, they were not economic. The costs have radically come down. The size of the funnel has radically opened. Therefore, the cost that you need to be economic is vastly different today. And this chart, you know, starts with almost 20% of the projects that have been identified for development today are economic below $30 oil. And even as you move up from 30 to 40 to 45, so 51% of projects are economic at $40 to $45 oil. So therefore, that's why we really think this business continues to move ahead in spite of the price volatility, because the cost has come down dramatically, so the margin is maintained even with a modest price and even with volatility in price. So therefore, that's what we think oil service is all about. It's all about the margin you make. And the cost is the key component that has radically changed and is sustainable for some 3, 4, 5 year period before cost creep really starts to creep in. So one is you've got projects that have been identified that are economic. The second one is you got to have the money, because these are $1 billion plus projects. There's a limited number of people in the world. So the major oil companies and the national oil companies are the few people who have the capability in terms of the capital to sanction projects. So this slide really highlights the fact that that's the other part of the equation, is who has the money and do they have the money? Because in the downturn, when prices did get lower, that has an immediate impact on the cash flows of even the majors. So even the majors probably weren't generating enough cash flows to sustain dividends, although they did sustain dividend, because that was the number one capital thing that they preserved, was the dividend payment. And then what the chart highlights is, first off, in the recent quarter, the cash flows of the major oil companies are higher than they've been at any time in the preceding 8 year period. So there's a dramatic increase in cash flows. There's also the question of how much of cash flow is available after the dividend payment, because the dividends are sacrosanct at these companies. And the chart here highlights that the cash flow after dividend payments in the last quarter was more than twice as much as it has been in any preceding quarter over this entire 8 year time period. So the majors have cash flows, therefore have the capacity and capability to commit that capital and have high return projects on which to commit them. So we think the continued unfolding of an increase in activity is the pieces are well in place. So many of you, if you've heard me speak, you know that I do think that Subsea 7 is a phenomenal company that is one of the beneficiaries that of all these same dynamics we talk about. And in looking at cyclical businesses, we do try to identify better businesses that do have some barriers to entry, even if cyclical, and therefore have more differentiation because the business is sustainable through full cycle, will generate higher returns, have owner operators, you know, with a subsidy has a 20% plus shareholder. And so therefore think about capital allocation in the right way, because capital allocation in capital intensive businesses that are cyclical is all the more important. When do you deploy capital is very dramatic. And having gone into the downturn with strong balance sheets, with a differentiated business, they've done a great job in improving the earnings power of the business. That said, but since you've already heard me talk about it, I'm going to talk about something else. So I'm going to talk about the offshore oil service business. And of course, last year, you know, we as our best pick of the year, we talked about a company called Secor Marine that's in the same space. And here's a little chart that shows all the public or number of the public participants in the offshore boat business. And we were feeling pretty good, patting ourselves on the back. That post the spinoff, we picked Secor Marine at an opportune time. Run again by quality management who are owner operators who have got a great record of capital deployment in a cyclical business and generating high teens return on invested capital. So therefore, you know, a logical company that was a beneficiary of a difficult time. Stock doubled by the middle of the year, and then the fourth quarter came and suddenly reset the table. So Secor Marine's back where it was, but I'm not going to talk about that one, which I do think is a great opportunity, but I'm going to talk to you about something different instead. We're going to go to somebody else in the boat business. The company I'm going to talk to you about today is Tidewater. Stock trades probably around $22 a share. It's got a $900 million market cap. It's got $100 million in net debt, so it's got $1 billion enterprise value. The balance sheet is extremely strong, and that is because in 2018, Tidewater went through a bankruptcy, wiped out all the debt, came out with some new debt, but the cash was equal to the debt. So an extremely strong balance sheet in an industry that's extremely troubled, with almost all the industry participants extremely over-leveraged. The company also was, of course, the balance sheet was recast based on fresh start accounting. And so for the book was written down to market values at the time, the book value of the assets depreciated, impaired, is probably three times where the book value is today. So you're buying the business and its assets at a fraction of what their historical depreciated cost is and what the replacement value is. Of course, we investing in the cyclical business, I also know that that's irrelevant. If who cares if you're buying the asset for less than what it's worth? It's really all about the future. Will that asset generate cash flow? Will that asset justify replacement? If that is so, that is relevant for the economic equation, because we don't care about the past. We don't care what was paid for the asset. That's an irrelevancy. It is really the earnings power of that asset that is clearly the important component. And we think Tidewater beats the bill, and we'll tell you why. They recently completed a merger at the end of last year with the other company in the industry that had also gone through bankruptcy and restructured. So also had a clean balance sheet, and that was Gulfmark. So the combination of the two companies definitely made them the largest player in the business, by far the largest fleet. But it's not assets that are important to investors. It's the equity that counts. And the assets are one piece of it. Many of these other companies still have very significant debt, and therefore have little or no equity. Tidewater's clean balance sheet, especially with the combination of Gulfmark, they do have almost all of it as equity, and we think that makes it interesting. Here's a chart that highlights the competitive landscape, and you can see Tidewater's got 4% debt to total market cap, total shareholder, I'll get it yet, total capitalization. In the meantime, you have Hornbeck, DOF, Solstad, Farstad, a Norwegian company, another North American. So all of these companies have 81, 95, 95, 96. So the debt is pretty much everything on the balance sheet. There's nominally any book equity. And more importantly, on the right-hand side, looks at the assets themselves and looks at estimates of secondhand value. This chart's provided by Clarksons, and we do think that Clarksons is an interesting company that has a huge amount of data, right, because the interesting stock kind of in and of its own right, differentiated company, and they're really in the business of buying and selling boats and ordering new ships and new buildings. So that business is not capital intensive. They're differentiated in terms of the size and scope of their business. But their knowledge of the new build market, the knowledge of the secondhand market is really important. And what this chart highlights is the estimates of secondhand value. Tidewater today trades at half of what the estimates are of their discounted current secondhand value today. More importantly, the rest of the industry has no equity. That the secondhand value of the vessels today exceeds the bank debt on all these companies. So therefore, all of these are we would think there's a huge differentiation in part of what we think is the investment opportunity. That Tidewater is a 6-foot athlete who is at the peak of his prime and extremely competent, and his competitors are 4-foot-5-inch short people who are crippled, and that creates huge opportunities for asset movement. And when you look in cyclical businesses at bottoms of cycles, the strong potentially have huge opportunity sets that they can expand. And we think that's absolutely the case here. The market cap of Tidewater probably is more than the market cap of all the other companies. And of course, we think most of those companies probably have no equity value. And so therefore, there's a huge differentiation. The key driver on offshore boat activity is offshore rigs, because one of the rules of thumb in the business is for every offshore rig, you need 3 boats. And so as drilling activity picks up, the boat activity picks up. So this is the leading indicator. And what you have seen over the last year is a pickup in activity. What you also see is continuing activity, more tenders, more rigs being going back to work. And so therefore, the leading indicator is more boat activity. One of the key markets is the North Sea. The North Sea last year already had a pickup in activity. And what you already see is there were more rigs contracted to work in the summer of 2019 than there were in 2018. So indications of continuing improvement in the market despite the volatility in oil prices. Oil price volatility is also, let me digress for a moment to another thought. It's all about oil that we all talk about, but it's really not about oil. There's oil and there's natural gas, right? And there are 2 kinds of natural gas, right? One is for domestic markets, and countries I would say are like Egypt and Israel, that the production goes onshore and it displaces the importation of oil at much higher costs. And so those businesses, even in the downturn, continued to have activity and development of new fields because there was demand in that market. The other part of natural gas is natural gas in places like Mauritania and Mozambique, where there is no domestic market. And therefore, the natural gas needs to be exported. That's a huge opportunity improvement today versus the last time this business was active. Natural gas discoveries were only economic and effective in countries that had local demand. The international market today has opened up. The LNG market has opened up. And so therefore, discoveries in Mozambique and Mauritania, where there are 2 major projects that will get sanctioned this year, are really predicated on the world international demand for natural gas. And that continues to grow. And the growth in that is definitely one of the compensating factors for some of the headwinds that oil probably faces in the next decade. Any business like this, is each one is a vertical. You know, who cares how many drilling rigs you have if you're in the boat business, because a rig can't do what a boat can do. You only care about the boats. So it's supply and demand for that vertical that's extremely important. One of the components is supply. Let's talk about that first. Here what you really have is capital does flow in. As the economic cycles tell you, that's what happened in this business. And therefore, there was new building activity has all dried up. No one's ordered a new vessel in 4 or 5 years. They've been canceling vessels. And so the last deliveries have been made. So there's no new growth that's coming to this industry in terms of new supply. What you also have is continued scrapping of the older vessels. There's a lot of vessels that have already gone away. And so here's a chart that actually indicates how many vessels have already been scrapped. But we think this really substantially underestimates what is the competitive supply out there today. And so here's a chart that kind of does go a little bit into that. The longer the vessel's been out of work, the classification of the vessel, the capability of the vessels, there's a lot of vessels that today are not working that never will work again. So we think the supply is overstated. How much it's overstated by, it's really difficult exactly to know. But every day also continues, the supply declines. The longer a boat has not worked, the less likely it will come back to work, because the more costly it will be to bring back into service, the lower the remaining useful life of the asset is, and therefore the higher the capital you'll have to lay out for the shorter the recovery period. So therefore, the fleet continues to atrophy and decline. The chart in the right-hand corner goes through how this vicious cycle kind of works and why the fleet will continue to dwindle in the real supply. The bottom right-hand side goes through some of the numbers in the PSV subsegment of the OSV industry that already says that approximately 60% of the vessels are already working. And then it goes through which ones the ones that really aren't working. And a significant component, the 443 rigs that are cold stacked for various reasons in terms of the time they've been out of class, the age of the vessel, the capability of the vessel, we definitely believe in the story that there's a significant portion of that capacity. It will not be competitive and not return to work, in which case potentially the available capacity that isn't working today is significantly less than is perceived by the marketplace. Here's a chart that goes through how many, what the vessel fleet might actually look like, where do you need rig activity, so just kind of goes through some numbers. But what you also have had is that not every vessel is the same thing. A boat, is, to you and me, a boat probably is the same thing. We don't know the difference. The fact of the matter is, in terms of what it can do and the capability of the boat, someone who hires that boat fully understands the differences between them. And you've seen that. There's a bifurcation between assets. So those bifurcation and the better assets, you've seen significant improvement over the last year to year and a half in terms of rates. And, you know, from as little as up 30% in the West African large PSVs to up as much as 50% in the mid-sized PSVs. So there's already been a significant differentiation and improvement in rates. Here's some of the classifications in terms of the quality question. And that's what it is. If it was built in a Western European market, 87% utilization is what the likelihood is. So in terms of the size of the vessel, therefore its capacity, more likely to be working. So does it have DP, dynamic positioning? Is it the second generation dynamic positioning? All of those are things that give the boat incremental capability and therefore efficiencies in its operations and therefore demand on the part of the rig operator. So there already is a significant differentiation. The other end of the spectrum are older boats, lower qualifications, lower and lower utilizations, those assets becoming less desirable, and the attrition of those vessels out of the fleet. Tidewater itself has a relatively young fleet. We think that, you know, they're well positioned. So not only is the balance sheet a differentiator, we also think that the assets themselves are differentiators in terms of the quality of the asset, therefore in demand and therefore improving and rate improvement sooner rather than later and full employment sooner rather than later. And why is that? Part of that is because over the preceding 10 years, the prior management that brought this company into bankruptcy, that took on too much debt, that overlevered it, did pay $4 billion to build new vessels. So the flip side is they bought an asset that is a valuable asset that has significant value, that has the generation, the capability to generate significant cash. And this is just the Tidewater fleet alone. This is not, we think, is a similar, now the differential between Tidewater and Gulfmark is three times the size on Tidewater. So there's probably another $1 billion that Gulfmark spent, same thing, in building relatively new vessels. So there's a significant expenditure of capital that we think are assets that are economic and strong today that will provide returns. The people factor, of course, is always important in an investment. And obviously, Tidewater, having gone through bankruptcy, part of the people equation was not clearly ideal. There was a management that had destroyed capital for whatever reason you can chalk that up to, but they did. The fact of the matter is, both in the restructuring, the CEO of Tidewater was dismissed, and now in the combination with Gulfmark, there's another opportunity. We think the people part of the equation is significantly enhanced by the Gulfmark. Not only did Gulfmark, as the other restructured company, who's the other potential consolidator in the business, come together with Tidewater. So take, instead of two potential consolidators, just one. So mitigating the potential conflict and competition between them. What you also had was the people have changed. So clearly the Tidewater board has indicated that there is a meritocracy in the new Tidewater. The CFO of the new Tidewater is the previous CEO of Gulfmark, who was acquired. So it wasn't, we acquire you, our people stay, we get rid of your people. It was who's the best people, who has the best capabilities. And so they brought over significant numbers of people in the senior management team of Gulfmark. So we think the new management team is also one that has been tested, but one that also has gone through this meritocracy test. In addition, very importantly, there are three new directors on the new Tidewater board, a Tidewater board that was originally placed by the creditors who became the equity owners in the deal. So therefore, some question on my part when we first were shareholders in it, what's the view of that board? How do they think about this business? Are they committed to the opportunity in front of it, or are they looking to recover the dollar value that their credit has lost and looking to move on? The Gulfmark board was definitely different. Gulfmark had a significant shareholder involved with it early on in the restructuring, had been on the board, and therefore I think you have really good capital allocation and you have the right risk tolerance that came over, and their incorporation into the Tidewater board is a fundamentally positive thing. So I think the combination and the meritocracy that you've seen through the management change are two positives, significant improvements to the management and to the ownership board of the new combined company. In addition, cyclical businesses that consolidated weak points of the cycle also get significant advantages, not only where their balance sheet's strong, but being able to take significant cost out of the equation at a low point in the cycle is extremely positive and increases the competitiveness of the company. So therefore, Tidewater in the combination with Gulfmark also did that. So, you know, their combined company had SG&A of $140 million. They'll take out $45 million. Some of it were in place kind of pre to that. Some of it was accelerated by the combination. So taking out $45 million on a company with 44 million shares outstanding, $1 a share of incremental earnings power that's been added to the business, you know, five times multiple on $1 a share is $5 on a $22 stock. That's a significant enhancement, we think, of the value of the company by combining at a weak point in the cycle and driving down costs and making yourself even more competitive. Here's a chart that the company has provided in terms of a bridge, in terms of where EBITDA is today, and identifiable things over the next year to two that we think play out in terms of what the opportunity set is. And this is the vessel operating margin, which is less than, right, that's before SG&A. But the number going in is probably a little over $100 million. There's identifiable things in play that potentially take that number up. And then with relatively modest rate improvements, we think there's a dramatic improvement that you're going to see in terms of what the vessel operating margin is. The vessel operating margin, the recovery, the improvement, the cost reductions, but here on a margin of safety, we're also going to highlight the fact that not only is the balance sheet clean, but the assets today, even at discounted secondhand values, are significantly higher than where the stock price is. So that gives you a dramatic margin of safety with the conviction and the comfort that since there's no debt, it isn't eroded and there isn't a leverage reduction in terms of that value. Conversely, we do point out the opportunity set that the company has because all of its competitors have no equity and the banks are still concerned and about repayment, and therefore there is still going to be the potential of forced liquidations that will occur, and therefore opportunity to opportunistically buy assets at low points in the cycle at a significant discount to the replacement value of the asset. That's an opportunity set almost unique to Tidewater in this space. Again, highlighting the margin of safety and the value thing, we're talking here about net book value of the company. And if you look at the last column on the right-hand side, we do that on a per vessel basis. And so we're talking about the current per vessel book value, which is higher than the current market price implied, is less than $9 million per vessel. A new vessel today built at a European yard at discounted prices, given the low level of activity in those yards, probably will cost you $50 million. So, of course, there's a stratification again, not all boats are the same, and that's the highest and best boat. But that tells you this is significant margin between what these vessels would cost to replace. And to go back earlier in our chart where we went through what the fleet capacity is today, what the boats that are in layup, of those boats in layup, which ones really are economic? Because that really does start to happen in our conversations with management. In the North Sea, for example, all the high specification vessels that really can work are working. And what they've done is drop down to the next class. And in the next class, most of those are working also. And therefore, in the next year, there's the expectation that many of those go back to work. Then you have to look at the next size down. Again, closer to the end of their useful life, much more money to bring it up out of service, to bring it back into service having been out. So the economic equation of that is difficult. And so we actually do foresee in the next couple of years the likelihood that demand in the business actually says, I'm going to need to build a new vessel. That's the best economic decision I can make. If you're going to build a vessel for $50 million, that's the best case, and you're going to get a 10% unlevered return on that, you probably need day rates somewhere around $30,000. In the chart that went through the bridge to increasing EBITDA over the next few years, in the high case, they estimate that you've got an improvement in rates of approximately $5,000 would get you to the higher number. The current rate is around $12,000. So therefore, 12, if you move up 5, you're at 17. The the gulf between 17 and 30 is dramatic. And so that's what we think is that over time you start to see new activity, new buildings, and therefore dramatic improvement. And so the 450 is really not best case, but it's really someplace that's in the next 2-3 years an identifiable opportunity, but we think there's significant opportunity beyond that. Where are risks? There are plenty of risks. You know, oil price is one of them. As I say, oil price, I think, is less of a risk here because it's really a cost equation, right? The costs have come down. Now, the oil price decline potentially, definitely, then reduces the oil company cash flows, therefore potentially moderates the oil company's capability interest in committing to larger capital, and therefore may delay projects. So, yes, they make sense. Yes, I have the capacity. I may not have the appetite. And so, therefore, that definitely is a risk that the activity slows down. We would actually, of course, we do realize that it would be better for the outcome in Tidewater probably the longer it takes for the recovery to come, because the more pain there will be to the rest of the industry, their ability to withstand all this pain is clear and obvious given the differential in terms of operating costs, the fleet they have, the balance sheet they have. So they are the beneficiary of difficult times. So a slowdown in this opportunity unfolding, we think actually accrues to and benefits Tidewater as the differentiated competitor in its space. Here's the disclosures, and one of the disclosures there is that we do own over 1% of the company. So you should know that, obviously, not surprising, we're talking up our own book. I think you'd be heartily disappointed if I was talking about a stock that I didn't own. John, questions?
Bob, thank you so much. A reminder to everyone on the line, if you have a question, feel free to type it into the online interface. Bob, you've talked to us in the past about energy and about a number of different ideas. Help us understand where this fits in the broader scheme of things for you within the energy space. And kind of the relative attractiveness.
Well, I do think that's what I think. I think the replacement cost of these assets are, you know, 3-4 times where they are today. I think that's what happens in the next 3-5 years. The activity level does pick up. That therefore replacement cost really becomes relevant. So the earnings power of this business is such that, you know, the assets, you know, will need to be replaced. And I think that's the opportunity. The balance sheet, therefore, also gives it the staying power. And as I say, the opportunity set probably significantly is enhanced given how strong that balance sheet is, how weak the competitors are. So the assets will not be constant. My guess is that the incremental advantages will accrue to them. The negative to the business is that, as I say, this is a commodity-like business. You know, there's thousands of boats. And so, yes, there's some differentiation between them, but a boat, even if it costs $50 million, is a modest amount of money. So 3 years ago when we visited with Tidewater, I did it as a throwaway because I really didn't have much to do when I was in New Orleans, and I figured I would talk to them, and I have an aversion to the business, having invested in oil and energy on offshore for 40 years, don't like the boat business. That said, the facts are such that the opportunity is really dramatic, and I think it's plain, and I think the risk is extremely moderate, given what the balance sheet looks like. So it's an odd one for us, and, you know, not my preference. My preference is to have better companies. And then even the, you know, ownership structure of it, it's okay, but there, you know, and there are, the new guys do own the stock, the new board members that came over from Gulfmark. So therefore, there really are owner operators who are aligned to own stock, and therefore, and that should influence decision-making at Tidewater, definitely positively. So there's an improving situation, and then it does happen. Because when we owned Acergy for all those years, the negative that there always was in Acergy was there wasn't an insider control shareholder. So therefore, the company did things that I didn't agree with. So in 2009, I wrote a letter to the board and met with the board and pushed them to do things with no success. You know, but then when they merged with Subsea 7, which was controlled by Christian Siem, that problem went away. And the opportunity came from someone who was a smart person, who really was a good capital allocator, now became a very significant shareholder in control of the company, control of capital allocation. And then suddenly, you know, I got a nice kiss because I got that benefit. So I do think that, you know, that's one of the things that's okay here, but I think improving. And I think that's what I did. I just got a kiss when they combined with Gulfmark, and I think that will continue to develop over time. What we also look for is you know, companies that are in niches that are have differentiation. And again, this doesn't have any niche differentiation. So it still has that commodity aspect, which moderates and more likely means that I would hope, I would expect the next cycle, I do not own Tidewater maybe, that, you know, it is an asset. This is a trading sardine. This is not an eating sardine. But today, this sardine is being given away at a very discounted price.
Point well taken. In terms of the industry consolidation, is this something that actually management has articulated, and do you expect that they will in fact start pursuing that?
Yeah, I think that they absolutely. We also recently talked to management, and you know, the any heavy lifting on the consolidation is complete within the next week or two. So they, you know, it's not that they're consumed with that process. It's done. It's over with. You know, there are tweaks. There are opportunities, too, from the combination. It's not just the cost-saving advantage, right? Tidewater had a much bigger footprint working around the world, and therefore the ability to move around vessels and even some that were in their fleet, optimize them in a different market that potentially has lower costs, that therefore had, you know, better margin, better demand. We know that that's going to happen. There are assets that Gulfmark had that were more troubled in the markets they were in that can easily work in other markets and get, you know, realize much higher value. So therefore, redeploying the asset, you know, is definitely there. We also do think that, you know, in one of the slides, we do have one of the other companies has no debt and again trades at half of what its, you know, secondhand value assets are today. But it's a much smaller company, so it doesn't have the scale and the capability to be a consolidator in the business as Tidewater can. Instead, we think it'll be the consolidated. So, and then of course the other player in the business, you know, who, you know, is extremely credible is still Seacor Marine, but Seacor Marine is staked out a very different strategy where they have niches that they compete in and they're sticking to those niches and they're looking for small deals because small deals are great add-ons because A, they're a smaller company to begin with and therefore they can do that and therefore the equations work out for that. So I think that, you know, there are these two companies that both will do well, that both, you know, Charles Fabricant sees the opportunity in the industry, understands the business, having been in it for decades, and therefore is continuing to opportunistically acquire assets, including he's got some shipyard new builds that were canceled that there is an opportunity on that he's buying. But that opportunity set's extremely limited, and I get conviction because Charles kicks those tires and looks. That's the kind of guy he is, and he identified the few that really do make sense and has entered into a great deal there. So and then one of the other things I do talk about is natural gas and also onshore, which market are you in? So, you know, an important component that we think is an industry opportunity and an energy opportunity is North America, you know, which is extremely long natural gas. And therefore there's this disconnection with the rest of the world's energy pricing environment in North America and North American energy. Is discounted, you know, at a quarter of the cost of energy other places around the world. And that'll continue to be the case because there's just a huge plentiful supply. So how do we invest in that in different ways than this? So, you know, there are other opportunities, verticals that I do think are prevalent and identifiable today.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Bob. It's always a pleasure to learn from you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And to all of you listening, join us for our next live session in just about 15 minutes. Goodbye for now.
Bye-bye. Thanks, John.
Thank you.